Second Treatise of Government by John Locke, first published in 1689. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 10 through 13. Chapter 10, The Forms of a Commonwealth. When men first unite into a society, a majority of them naturally have the whole power of the community, and may employ all that power in making laws for the community, and enforcing those laws through officials they have appointed. When that happens, the form of the government is a thorough democracy, or they may put the law-making power into the hands of a select few, and their heirs or successors, and then the government is an oligarchy. If they put the power into the hands of one man, their government is a monarchy, which may be either hereditary or elective. Out of these possibilities, a community may make compounded and mixed forms of government, if they see fit to do so. And if the majority first give the legislative power to one or more persons for their lifetimes or for some stipulated period, taking the supreme power back after that time has elapsed, then the community may dispose of it in any way they please, and so set up a new form of government. For the form of government depends on where the supreme power is placed, and the supreme power is the legislative power. I use commonwealth throughout this work to mean not a democracy or any other specific form of government, but more generally, any independent community, that is, any community that is not part of a larger political community. The Latin word for this was civitas, for which the best English translation is commonwealth. Used correctly, it stands for a society of men of the kind I've been talking about, which community and city in English do not. For there may be subordinate communities under a single government, and we use city to mean something quite different from commonwealth. So please let me avoid ambiguity by using the word commonwealth in the sense I have explained, the sense in which I find it used by King James I, what I think to be its genuine sense. If you don't like it, feel free to substitute something else. Chapter 11. The Extent of the Legislative Power. The great purpose for which men enter into society is to be safe and at peace in their use of their property, and the great instrument by which this is to be achieved is the laws established in that society. So the first and fundamental positive law of any commonwealth is the establishing of the legislative power, and the first and fundamental natural law, which should govern even the legislature itself, is the preservation of the society, and, as far as the public good allows it, the preservation of every person in it. This legislature is not only the supreme power of the commonwealth, but is sacred and unalterable in the hands in which the community have placed it, and no other person or organization can make edicts that have the force of law, and create obligations as a law does, unless they have been permitted to do so by the legislature chosen and appointed by the public. Without this, the law would lack something it absolutely must have, if it is to be a law, namely, the consent of the society. Nobody has power to subject a society to laws except with the society's consent and by its authority, and therefore all the obedience that anyone can owe, even under the most solemn obligations, ultimately terminates in this supreme power, the legislature of the commonwealth, and is governed by the laws it enacts. No oaths to any foreign power, or any subordinate power in a man's own commonwealth, can free him from his obedience to the legislature. Though the legislature is the supreme power in every commonwealth, there are four important things to be said about what it may not do. First, it doesn't, and can't possibly, have absolutely arbitrary power over the lives and fortunes of the people. For the legislative power is simply the combined power of every member of the society, which has been handed over to the person or persons constituting the legislature. There can't be more of this power than those people had in the state of nature before they entered into society and gave their power to the community. Nobody can transfer to someone else more power than he has himself, and nobody has an absolute arbitrary power to destroy his own life or take away someone else's life or property. A man in the state of nature has no arbitrary power over the life, liberty, or possessions of someone else. He has only as much freedom or moral power as the law of nature gave him, for the preservation of himself and everyone else. This is all the power he has. So it is all he can give up to the Commonwealth, and thus to the legislature. So the legislature can't have more than this. The outer limit of its power is set by the good of the society as a whole. It is a power whose only purpose is preservation, and therefore the legislature can never have a right to destroy, enslave, or deliberately impoverish the subjects. The obligations of the law of nature don't cease in society. In many cases, indeed, they are stricter there, with human laws enforcing them and punishing breaches of them. Thus the law of nature stands as an eternal rule to all men, legislators as well as others. The rules that legislators make for other men's actions must conform to the law of nature, which is a declaration of the will of God. The fundamental law of nature enjoins the preservation of mankind, and no human sanction can be valid against it. Second, the legislature, or supreme authority, cannot give itself a power to rule by sudden, arbitrary decrees. It is bound to dispense justice and decide the rights of the subject by published standing laws and known authorized judges. The law of nature is unwritten, and thus can be found only in the minds of men. So when people misstate or misapply it, whether through passion or through self-interest, it is hard to convince them they are wrong, when there isn't an established judge to appeal to. For this reason, the law of nature doesn't serve as well as it should, to determine the rights and protect the properties of those who live under it, especially where everyone is judge, interpreter, and enforcer of it too, even in his own case. To avoid these drawbacks which disorder property in the state of nature, men unite into societies, so as to have the united strength of the whole society to secure and defend their properties, and have standing rules to hold the society together, rules that let everyone know what is his. The purposes of society and government are not consistent with either absolute arbitrary power or governing without settled standing laws. Men wouldn't quit the freedom of the state of nature for a governed society and tie themselves up under it, if it weren't to preserve their lives, liberties, and fortunes with help from stated rules of right and property. It can't be thought that they should intend to give to anyone an absolute arbitrary power over their persons and estates, and strengthen the law officer's hand so that he could do anything he liked with them. If they did, they would be disarming themselves, and arming someone else to prey on them as he chose. Whatever the form of the Commonwealth, its ruling power ought to govern by laws that have been published and taken in, and not by spur-of-the-moment dictates and frivolous decisions. This achieves two things. One is that the people know their duty, and are safe and secure within the limits of the law. The other is that the rulers are kept within their bounds, and are not tempted by their power to employ it for purposes and by means that they don't want the public to know and wouldn't willingly own up to. Third, the supreme power can't take any part of a man's property without his consent. What men enter into societies with governments for is the preservation of their property. So it would be a gross absurdity to have a government that deprived them of that very property. So men in society have property, which means they have such a right to the goods that are theirs, according to the law of the community, and nobody has a right to take any part of those goods from them without their own consent. Otherwise, they would have no property at all, for something isn't really my property if someone else can rightfully take it from me against my will whenever he pleases. Hence, it is a mistake to think that the supreme or legislative power of a commonwealth can do what it likes, and dispose of the estates of a subject arbitrarily, or take any part of them that it fancies. There is not much fear of this with governments where the legislature involves assemblies, whose membership varies, one whose members, when the assembly disbands, are subjects under the common laws of their country on a par with everyone else. But in governments where the legislature is one lasting assembly that is always in existence, or one man, as in absolute monarchies, there is a danger that the governors will think they have interests different from those of the rest of the community, and so will be apt to increase their own riches and power by taking whatever they want from the people. This would obviously be a terrible situation, for a man's property is not at all secure, even if there are fair laws protecting it from his fellow subjects, if those who command those subjects have the power to take from any one of them any part of his property that they want, and use and dispose of it as they choose. Sometimes it is necessary for power to be absolute, but that doesn't mean it is arbitrary. Even absolute power, when legitimate, is restricted to the purposes that require it to be absolute. To see that this is so, look at the usual form of military discipline: the preservation of the army, and through that the preservation of the whole commonwealth, requires absolute obedience to the command of every superior officer. And even when a command is dangerous or unreasonable, disobedience to it is rightly punished with death. And yet a sergeant who could command a soldier to march up to the mouth of a cannon, or stand in a breach in the defensive walls where he is almost sure to be killed, may not command that same soldier to give him one penny of his money. A general who can condemn the soldier to death for deserting his post, or for disobeying the most desperate orders, may not, for all his absolute power of life and death, help himself to the least little thing among that soldier's possessions. The reason for the difference is clear. The commander has his power for a purpose, namely, the preservation of all the people. For that purpose, blind obedience is necessary, and that is why the general can command anything, and hang men for the least disobedience, whereas taking a soldier's goods has nothing to do with that purpose. It is true that governments need a great deal of money for their support, and it is appropriate that each person who enjoys his share of the protection should pay his proportion of the cost. But it must be with his consent, that is, the consent of the majority, given either directly by themselves or through representatives they have chosen. For if anyone claims a power to impose taxes on the people by his own authority, and without such consent of the people, he is invading the fundamental law of property, and subverting the purpose of government. Fourth, the legislature cannot transfer the power of making laws to any other hands. It is delegated to them from the people, and they are not free to pass it on to others. Only the people can decide the form of the commonwealth, which they do by instituting a legislature and deciding whose hands to put it into. The power of the legislature being derived from the people by a positive voluntary grant and institution can't be anything different from what that positive grant conveyed, namely, the power to make laws, not to make legislatures. So the legislature can have no power to transfer to anyone else their authority to make laws. The legislative power of every commonwealth, and every form of government, is subject to the following limits: to the trust that is put in them by the society, and by the law of God, and the law of nature. Firstly, they are to govern by published established laws, not to be varied in particular cases, but to have one rule for rich and poor, for the favourite at court, and the peasant at his plough. Secondly, these laws ought to be designed for no purpose but the good of the people. Thirdly, they must not raise taxes on people's property without their consent, whether given directly or through deputies. This is relevant only for governments where the legislature is always in existence, or at least where the people haven't made any provision for some part of the legislature to be chosen from time to time by themselves. Fourthly, the legislature must not transfer the power of making laws to anyone else, or place it anywhere but where the people have placed it. Chapter 12. The Legislative, Executive, and Federative Powers of the Commonwealth. It is the legislative power that has a right to direct how the force of the Commonwealth shall be employed for preserving the community and its individual members. But laws that are to be continuously in force, and constantly enforced, don't take much time to make, so there is no need for the legislature to be always in existence. In well-ordered commonwealths, where the good of the whole is properly taken into account, the legislative power is put into the hands of a number of people who have, when assembled, a power to make laws, after which they are to separate again and are to be subject to the laws they have made. This arrangement helps to keep a rein on them, so that they will be careful to legislate for the public good. An alternative would be for the legislators to be continuously in government service, filling the times between legislative sessions by acting as executors of the law. But this is rightly rejected in well-ordered commonwealths, because it may be too great a temptation to human, power-seeking frailty for the very people who have the power to make laws, also to have the power to enforce them. For if they did, they might come to exempt themselves from obedience to the laws they had made, and to adapt the law, both in making and in enforcing it, to their own private advantage. That would separate their interests from those of the rest of the community, which would be contrary to the purpose of society and government. But once a law has been swiftly made, it has a constant and lasting force, and needs to be applied at all times, or at least there must always be someone on duty to enforce it when necessary. So there must be a power that, unlike the legislature, is always in existence, a power that will see to the enforcement of the laws that have been made and not repealed. That is how the legislative and executive powers come to be separated in many commonwealths. In every commonwealth there is another power that one may call natural, because it corresponds to the power every man naturally had before he entered into society. The members of a commonwealth are separate individuals governed by the laws of the society, but in relation to the rest of mankind they constitute one body, which relates to the rest of mankind in the way the individual members related to one another in the state of nature. So when any member of the society gets into a controversy with someone from outside it, the affair is managed by the public, and if a member of the political body is harmed by an outsider, the whole body is engaged in getting reparation. This whole body, therefore, has the power of war and peace, leagues and alliances, and all transactions with individuals and communities outside the commonwealth. This power may be called federative. As long as the thing is understood, I am not interested in the name. These two powers, executive and federative, are distinct from one another. One involves the enforcement of the society's laws upon all its members, while the other involves the management of the security and interest of the public in relation to outsiders from whom it may receive benefit or damage. Although this federative power is of great importance to the Commonwealth, it is much less capable than the executive power of being directed by antecedent, standing, positive laws, and so it must necessarily be left to the prudence and wisdom of those with the power to exercise it for the public good. The reason for this difference is as follows. The laws concerning how subjects relate to one another are meant to direct their actions, and so need to precede them. But the function of the federative power is not to direct the actions of citizens, but rather to respond to the actions of foreigners, and the plans and interests of foreigners vary so greatly they can't be anticipated by a set of standing laws for each eventuality. So the federative power must be left mainly to the prudence of those who have this power committed to them, to be managed by the best of their skill for the advantage of the commonwealth. Though the executive and federative powers of every community are distinct, they are hardly to be separated and put into the hands of distinct sets of people, for they both require the force of the society for their exercise, and it is hardly practicable to place the force of the commonwealth in distinct hands, neither subordinate to the other. If the executive and federative powers were given to different groups of people, they might act separately, thus putting the force of the public under different commands, and that would be apt at some time or other to cause disorder and ruin. Chapter 13. The Subordination of the Powers of the Commonwealth. In a constituted commonwealth, standing on its own basis and acting for the preservation of the community, there can be only one supreme power, the legislative power, to which all the rest must be subordinate. But this is only a fiduciary or entrusted power to act for certain ends, so that the people retain a supreme power to remove or alter the legislature when they find it acting contrary to the trust that had been placed in it. All power that is given with trust for attaining a certain end is limited by that purpose. When the purpose is obviously neglected or opposed by the legislature, the trust is automatically forfeited, and the power returned into the hands of those who gave it. They may then make a new assignment of it to whomever they think best for their safety and security. And thus the community never loses its supreme power of saving itself from the attempts and plans of anybody, even of its own legislators, if they are so foolish or so wicked as to develop plans against the liberties and properties of the subjects. No man or society of men has a power to hand over their preservation, or therefore the means to it, to the absolute will and arbitrary dominion of anyone else. So when someone tries to bring them into that slavish condition, they will always have a right to preserve the liberty that they don't have the power to part with, and to rid themselves of those who invade this fundamental, sacred, and unalterable law of self-preservation that was their reason for entering into society in the first place. In this respect, the community may be said to be always the supreme power, though this power of the people can never be exercised until after the government has been dissolved. In some commonwealths, where the legislature is not always in existence, and the executive power is given to a single person who also has a share in the legislative power, that single person can, in a reasonable sense, be called supreme. It's not that he has all the supreme power, that is, the power of lawmaking, and he has only a share in it, but he does have the supreme executive power, from which all the lower law officers derive all or most of their various subordinate powers. Also, he has no legislature superior to him, because no law can be made without his consent, and he can't be expected to consent to any that would make him subject to the other part of the legislature. But notice that although oaths of allegiance and loyalty are taken to him, it is to him not as supreme legislator, but as supreme executor of the law that he and others jointly made. For allegiance is nothing but obedience according to law. This distinction is important, because if this supreme executor violates the law, he then has no right to obedience. He can claim obedience not as a private person, but only as the public person vested with the power of the law. He is to be considered as the image or representative of the Commonwealth, empowered by the will of the society as declared in its laws, and thus he has no will, no power, other than that of the law. If he leaves this representative function, this public will, and acts by his own private will, he demotes himself and becomes again a single private person, with no power or will that has any right to obedience. When the executive power is placed anywhere other than in a person with a share in the legislature, it is visibly subordinate and accountable to the legislature, which can place it elsewhere if it chooses. So what is exempt from being subordinate to anyone or anything is not the supreme executive power as such, but rather that power when held by someone who has a share in the legislature. That person has no distinct superior legislature to be subordinate and accountable to, except in ways that he will consent to, so that he is only as subordinate as he himself thinks he should be, which certainly won't be much. I needn't discuss other delegated and subordinate powers in the Commonwealth. They are so many and so infinitely various across the different customs and constitutions of distinct commonwealths that it's impossible to describe them in detail. All I need for my purposes is to point out that none of them has any authority beyond what is explicitly delegated to it, and all are accountable to some other power in the Commonwealth. It isn't necessary, or even advisable, that the legislature should be in existence continuously, but it's absolutely necessary that the executive power be. There isn't always a need for new laws to be made, but there is always a need for laws that have been made to be enforced. When the legislature puts the enforcement of the laws they make into the hands of a separate executive power, they retain the power to take it back again, if they find cause to do so, and to punish the executive for any conduct that goes against the laws. The same holds for the federative power, because both it and the executive are powers that have been delegated by the legislature and are subordinate to it. The legislature may assemble and exercise their legislative power at the times specified by their original constitution, or at their adjournment, or, if no time has been specified by either, and no other procedure is prescribed for convoking them, they may meet at any time they please. In writing about when the legislature may assemble, I have been assuming that it consists of several persons. If it is a single person, it will of course be in existence continuously, and will naturally have the supreme executive power as well as the supreme legislative power. It may delegate executive power, perhaps to one person, but he won't ever have supreme executive power, because it isn't ever true of him that he has no legislature superior to him. If the legislature, or any part of it, is made up of representatives chosen by the people for a specified period of time, after which they are to return to the ordinary condition of subjects, and to have no further share in the legislature, unless they are chosen again, this power of choosing again must also be exercised by the people, either at certain appointed times, or else when they are called to it. In the latter case, the power of convoking the legislature by calling for a general election is ordinarily given to the executive, and is to be exercised in one of these two ways. If the original constitution lays down the intervals at which the legislature is to assemble and act, all the executive power must do is dutifully issue directions for the proper conduct of the election and the assembly. Otherwise, it is left to the executive's prudence to call for new elections when the benefits or needs of the public require the amendment of old laws, or the making of new ones, or the correction or prevention of any misfortunes that have occurred or are threatening the people. You may want to ask, what of the executive power, using the armed forces of the Commonwealth, prevents the legislature from meeting and acting at a time when its original constitution specifies that it should meet, or when the needs of the Commonwealth require it to do so? I reply, someone who uses force against the people, without authority and contrary to the trust they have given him, puts himself into a state of war with the people. They have a right to oppose this executive and reinstate their legislature in the exercise of its power. They have set up a legislature intending it to exercise the power of making laws, either at certain set times or when there is a need for it. And when the legislature is hindered by any force from doing what the society needs for its safety and preservation, the people have a right to remove that force by force. In all states and conditions, the true remedy for unauthorized force is to oppose it with force. The executive's power of assembling and dismissing the legislature doesn't make him superior to it. This power has been entrusted to him for the safety of the people, in a situation where human affairs were too uncertain and variable for there to be a fixed rule, settling in advance when the legislature could be assembled and disbanded. Those who first set up the government couldn't possibly see into the future well enough to know in advance exactly what timetable for the legislature would, for all time to come, meet the needs of the Commonwealth. Constant, frequent meetings of the legislature, and unnecessary continuations of their assemblies, would be burdensome to the people, and would be bound eventually to produce more dangerous drawbacks. Affairs might sometimes develop so fast that the legislature's help was needed immediately, so that any delay in their convening might endanger the public. Sometimes, too, their business might be so great that a time-limited sitting would be too short for their work, and rob the public of benefits that only their mature deliberation could bring. To save the community from each of these dangers, what could be done other than entrusting the power to call the Legislative Assembly into session to the prudence of someone who was always present, knew the state of public affairs, and could use this prerogative for the public good? So, given that the regulation of times for the assembling of the legislature was not settled by the original constitution, it naturally fell into the hands of the executive, not as an arbitrary power for him to exercise however he chose, but as something he was trusted to use for the public good, as changing circumstances might require. It is not my business to consider what is the least inconvenient. Settled periods for the legislature to convene, the monarch left free to convoke the legislature, or a mixture of those two systems. All I have wanted is to show that though the executive power may have the prerogative of convoking and dissolving such assemblies of the legislature, that doesn't make it superior to the legislature. Things in this world are in such a constant flux that nothing remains for long in the same state. Thus people, riches, trade, and power change their positions. Flourishing mighty cities come to ruin, and end up as neglected, desolate corners, while other empty places grow into populous regions, filled with wealth and inhabitants. But things don't always change equally, and the reasons for various customs and privileges may cease to apply, though people, for their own purposes, keep the customs and privileges in place. So it often happens in governments, where part of the legislature consists of representatives chosen by the people, that in the course of time this representation becomes very unequal and disproportionate to the reasons that first supported it. To see what gross absurdities can come from following a custom when there is no longer reason for it, consider the fact that the mere name of a town, of which not even the ruins remain, with virtually no housing beyond a sheep pen and no inhabitants beyond a single shepherd, may send as many representatives to the Grand Assembly of Lawmakers as a whole rich and populous county. Foreigners stand amazed at this, and everyone must admit that it needs to be remedied, but most people think it is hard to find a remedy, and here is why. The setting up of the legislature was the original and supreme act of the society, coming before any of the positive laws that it passed, and depending wholly on the people, so no inferior power can alter it. Thus, once the legislature has been set up, in the kind of government I have been speaking of, the people have no power to act as long as the government stands, and this inconvenience is thought by some to be incapable of a remedy. The welfare of the people is the supreme law, is certainly so just and fundamental a rule that no one who sincerely follows it can go dangerously wrong. So it is open to the executive, who has the power of convoking the legislature, to do this. Regulate the number of members of the legislature, that each place has a right to have as its representatives, basing this not on precedent, but on facts about population, not on custom, but on true reason. If the executive does this, it can't be judged to have set up a new legislature, but only to have restored the old and true one, and to have rectified the disorders that the passage of time had gradually and inevitably introduced. For it is the interest as well as the intention of the people to have fair and equal representation. So whoever brings it nearest to that is an undoubted friend to government, and must have the consent and approval of the community. For a monarch's prerogative is nothing but his power to provide for the public good in cases where, because of unforeseen and uncertain events, certain and unalterable laws could not safely be relied on. Any exercise of the prerogative does and always will count as just if it is done manifestly for the good of the people, and for establishing the government on its true foundations. The power of establishing new municipalities, and thus new representatives, carries with it a supposition that in time the proportions of representation might vary. Places might come to have a just right to be represented, though they had none before, and places that had previously been represented might cease to have that right, and be regarded as too inconsiderable for such a privilege. What tends to subvert government is not mere change from the present state, but the tendency of change to injure or oppress the people, and unfairly subject one part of the populace to the rest. Whatever is obviously of advantage to the society and to people in general, upon just and lasting measures, will always justify itself. And whenever the people choose their representatives upon just and undeniably equal measures, suitable to the original scheme of the government, it must be agreed to be the will and act of the society, whoever permitted or caused them to do so. End of chapters 10 through 13.